From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. Throughout the years, we've seen dietitians and nutritionists offer different and sometimes conflicting advice when it comes to what we should eat to stay healthy. Arguably, the most visible expression of this advice has been the U.S. government's food pyramid. The original, from 1992, put a big emphasis on bread, cereal, grains, and rice. Those foods were on the bottom, the widest part, from which we were to eat the most. At the top of the pyramid, the narrowest part, from which we were to eat the least, there were fats, oils, and sweets. Then, in 2005, it was changed to look more like a tent, which seemed to balance the different foods you can eat, though fats weren't mentioned at all. Again, in 2011, another change, the pyramid and the tent were phased out in favor of a plate. Mostly balanced this time, no mention of fats. But now, the food pyramid is back, though this time it's inverted. The government suggests whole grains should not be a significant portion of your diet, and instead suggests putting a bigger emphasis on protein, whole fat dairy, and healthy fats. Fruits and vegetables make up a significant portion of the pyramid as well. Now, this new pyramid has come at a time when food manufacturers are emphasizing protein products. Have you seen they're even selling protein water now? This is a conversation we first had in January, when the new pyramid had just come out, and at the time, we asked our texting group about it. Terry in Batavia said, "One more non-scientifically based bad idea, probably sponsored by the meat and dairy lobbies. I'll continue eating vegetarian meals, lots of veggies, whole grain, fruit, nuts, etc., as recommended by legitimate dietitians and nutritionists. It appears this administration is focused on making America less healthy." Thank you for that text, Terry. Joining us for this conversation was Carmen Ramos, Assistant Professor of Nutrition and Dietetics at Northern Illinois University, and Jennifer Barnes, Professor of Food, Nutrition, and Dietetics at Illinois State University. Because our program's on tape today, we're not taking live calls, but you can always let us know what you thought. Our email address is talk@21stshow.org. All right, Carmen, so let's just start with sort of a baseline. What do you think of the new guidelines, the new pyramid?
Most definitely. Thank you. So the new dietary guidelines for Americans, as a more of like an overview, they are official federal nutrition recommendations that are updated every 5 years by the USDA and also the Health and Human Services. And with that, they provide like this evidence-based advice on like what to eat and drink to meet like nutrient needs, promote health, and really help prevent chronic disease. And with that, primarily at the population and policy level. So there are a couple of conflicting messages that have arisen from the new dietary guidelines. And what we're seeing is that this new edition, the 2025 to 2030 edition, places this emphasis on many things that I, as a registered dietitian, 100% recommend. And so do many of my registered dietitian colleagues. And so what we're thinking about is consumption of real foods, or in terms of like minimally processed foods like whole foods, and really prioritizing nutrient dense foods like fruits, vegetables, dairy, and high quality protein sources.
The edge of the grocery store, as they say, right? Or the borders
exactly,
of the grocery store.
Yes. Mm-hmm. On the outskirts. And so what we're seeing is that this consuming more fruits and vegetables, eating more fiber, maintaining a limit of no more than 10% of total calories from saturated fat. These are all things that, of course, we have. There's great evidence to support. Now, where the controversies arise is that the new inverted food pyramid does not exactly match what is represented in the written guidelines in some ways. So, for example, the emphasis on red meat and full fat dairy, and consistently not only like, oh, yes, as you may enjoy throughout your meals, maybe like once or twice a day and so forth. What they're really placing an emphasis is, and if you see the pyramid, it's about like maybe it would account for maybe 40% of your total calories. And with that, the recommendation of limiting saturated fat to 10% of calories, that would actually add up really quick if in case that we are if in case that you are consuming saturated fat or products. And so to put it in perspective, if you consume like a portion of red meat and then also a glass of whole milk in one meal, that would account for almost about half of your recommended limit of the 10% of calories. And so this is inconsistent messaging that can confuse not only the public, but also healthcare professionals.
Jennifer, what do you think about the new pyramid, broadly speaking?
I think Dr. Ramos did an excellent overview of the dietary guidelines and the new pyramid. I agree with everything she said. I will add that I think we've done a disservice to our clinicians as well as to the public by reverting back to a pyramid. My plate was an excellent education and counseling tool for clinicians to use with patients and clients. It was translatable to real life and represented an image that the public understood. It's really difficult to look at this pyramid and determine how you should plan your meals based on this symbol. Dr. Ramos gave us some example calculations, which are really helpful to understand how our saturated fat may add up if we follow this image. But the general population isn't really in a position to do that easily, right? I would even need to look up values in order to make that same estimation. So I think one of the big issues here is we've lost the translatability to people's day-to-day life by moving backwards to another pyramid.
Carmen Ramos, let me ask you about, you mentioned evidence-based. This is evidence-based. And yet it's different from what was out there 33 years ago, I guess, when the first 34 years ago, when the first one came out, because you know, then it was a lot of whole grains and rice. That was the base of the pyramid. Now the base, or the widest part of the pyramid, because it's inverted, the widest part is, you know, protein, dairy, healthy fats, also vegetables and fruits. So what do you make of that? Has the evidence changed, or is something else happening?
Most definitely. I think that when we talk about the evidence, I think it's important to really focus on how time and time again, this has been from 20 years of research, 30 years of research, is that fiber is a really big deal with prevention of chronic disease and even management of chronic disease. It has been consistently shown to support gut health, help regulate blood sugar, lowers cholesterol, and then also helps with feelings of fullness during times, during mealtimes. And really what we have seen and what we have studied from epidemiology research is that most adults fall well short of their fiber recommendations significantly. And with that, with whole grains, of course, that is going to be one of the main ways that you can obtain that fiber. And then it not only is a good source of fiber, but it also contains many other vitamins and minerals that are also important for overall health, such as B vitamins, iron, magnesium, plant compounds, and so forth. So that's one thing, is that the research has shown again and again that fiber is quite critical in terms of prevention of health and promoting health and prevention of chronic disease. Now, with that as well, other sources of fiber are also, of course, fresh fruits and vegetables. And so with that, the new guidelines do, I would say that they still promote fiber in the case that they do promote that fruits and vegetables should be at least, if you see within the pyramid, I would say like about 40% of daily consumption, of your daily consumption.
Jennifer Barnes, what do you think about the idea of, you know, there's we have this, you can go back decades now, right? There was Atkins, there's the, what was it, the California, I get the terms mixed up, Mediterranean diet, right? There's always seems like there's some sort of fad eating trend happening in the world. Now everybody is focused on protein. Can you talk about that and how, you know, those changes happen over time? Are those evidence-based? Does that have anything to do with this government advice we're seeing now?
Sure. I'll start by acknowledging that Americans love a fad diet, right? We love an idea of a relatively quick solution for achieving our weight management and body composition goals. And high protein in some ways is just, like you alluded to, Brian, the current fad. There are some definitely interesting things about protein, right? So we have three nutrients that provide calories for us in our day-to-day lives: carbohydrates, protein, and fat. Carbohydrates and fat providing energy is really like their main thing, but protein has a lot of other jobs for us. It, of course, helps build muscle, bone, helps us move things through the body, helps with fluid balance. So protein is kind of special for our energy-containing nutrients in that it has some jobs that nothing else can do. So the fad for protein now is a little bit more interesting because of that. People are interested in protein to try to maintain lean body mass in the face of weight loss, or increase lean body mass if they are doing resistance training. Protein's associated with satiety. So there's a lot of reasons why protein is an attractive nutrient to try to emphasize. But just like with all other fad diets, those other nutrients remain really important. Carbohydrates have a really important place for providing energy, and like Dr. Ramos was just saying, providing us with fiber. Most of us don't get enough of that. Fat provide us with energy, provide us with padding and insulation. So they all remain important. And so I think the overriding message should still be that we need all of our nutrients in the appropriate balance. And while protein may have some attributes that are a little bit more interesting than carbohydrates and fat, we still need all of those things in balance. I suspect moving forward, we'll probably move on to another fad diet. Whether or not the current fad of protein being something that people are emphasizing has influenced the dietary guidelines, I'm not certain about that. I think your comment at the beginning read from a listener. I believe his name was Terry. I think he may have brought up some good points about some lobbying groups that may have influenced the getting protein at the top of the pyramid. Whether or not the fad influenced the pyramid, I'm not sure. We work on these guidelines for 5 years at a time, in theory. So, unsure about that point.
Yeah, I do think it's interesting and worth noting that the guidelines not only come from health authorities in the government, but it's the United States Department of Agriculture that does or has a significant role in this. And in fact, it's their website that's hosting this new guidelines, at least the one that I clicked on. Carmen Ramos, we have a few minutes until we need to take a break. I want to, we talked about there's this guidance about ultra processed foods. I remember having a conversation with a healthcare professional some years ago about my affinity. Which they don't even make this cereal anymore, but Total Raisin Bran, right? Which promised X number of vitamins and minerals in every bowl. And this person said to me, well, that's great if you want your vitamins sprayed on your food. So what is talk about this, like this protein fad in the context of like ultra processed foods, right? Are these things just being engineered to make advertising claims on nutrition labels, or what's happening here?
Right. That's a really great point. And what we do see is that protein. I know that I was talking to someone about protein water is a really good example. So we have like protein water, we have protein Pop-Tarts and so forth. So with that, one thing that is really a concern when individuals focus too heavily on like these protein ultra processed sources is that they can unintentionally crowd out other important nutrients, especially as we were talking about fiber, which most Americans do not consume enough of. And if it really helps someone meet their nutritional needs and fits their lifestyle, that's completely fine, but it's not necessarily for most people. And really, it's not a substitute for balanced meals. Really, what I would say to that is that protein is important, but more isn't always better, and especially when they're combined with ultra processed foods. And protein alone doesn't define a healthy diet. And I would really and myself, along with many of my dietitian friends, we encourage many of these from whole food products. Now, the one issue is food access and affordability is the other thing that I don't think that we have touched on with many of this. So I know that a lot of the times it can be easy to recommend, oh, like let's take a step back from ultra processed foods and really consume like whole foods, or purchase like the fresh fruits and vegetables in the grocery store, or like the fresh chicken. However, one of the main considerations is that we're and that the dietary guidelines doesn't address, or that we have also addressed currently to this point right now as we're talking, is food access and food affordability. And that is a real issue that many Americans are facing, not being able to put food on their table. and simply us giving the recommendations. So sometimes, you know, those ultra processed foods, like if we're talking about, yes, like the cereals, if they're able to consume that and they're getting their B vitamins from it, and then they're also getting some fiber from it, I would say go more than right ahead, because I think what it really comes down to is being able to consider making sure that individuals are obtaining the nutrients that they need.
All right, we're going to take a brief break on the program. Again, no calls for the hour today because we're on tape, but we did hear from some of you by text when we first aired this conversation back in January. Jill in Homer, Illinois, said she spent 8 years at SNAP Ed, which is the education branch of the program formerly known as food stamps. Jill says she used to recommend that children under 2 years of age drink whole fat milk, and then switch to 2% or less because the brain has been further developed and doesn't require as many nutrients from the fat. She's upset that the government is now recommending whole fat milk for older children as well. We'll get into that recommendation with our guests after a short break. They are Carmen Ramos at Northern Illinois University and Jennifer Barnes from Illinois State. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're listening back to our conversation on the new U.S. dietary guidelines, which include a food pyramid that's been inverted. Whole grains are de-emphasized in favor of more protein, whole-fat dairy, and fruits and vegetables. But as we've been discussing, that's what the pyramid suggests. The actual written guidelines tell a somewhat different story. We heard from some of you via text when this first aired in January. Tony in Champaign says, I'm into fiber, not protein. Jesse in Mattoon said, I think emphasis on meat is this administration's way of trying to make up for tariffs. Beef in particular uses a lot of grains for feed, thus boosting the demand domestically, and that will in turn help farmers. No science behind it, just a flimsy attempt to make things right for the constituents he lied to, Jesse says. Joining us for this conversation was Jennifer Barnes, professor of food, nutrition, and dietetics at Illinois State University, and Carmen Ramos, assistant professor of nutrition and dietetics at Northern Illinois University. Jennifer Barnes, can we talk about sugars and carbohydrates? And, you know, this relates to Atkins. I read that book. I know Gary Taubes is, you know, sometimes controversial among some people in nutrition science, but, you know, the case against sugar, how does that relate to everything that's happening here? And, you know, I guess this itself had its own fad diet turn with keto and paleo and things like that a few years back.
Sure. So the first thing I want to point out about carbohydrates is that they are your body's preferred source of energy. We need carbohydrates. Our brain loves to run on carbohydrates. And so consuming carbohydrates is an important part of everybody's day to day. In fact, the dietary reference intakes say that the majority of our energy should come from carbohydrates. Now, that doesn't address quality of carbohydrates. And we've been getting to this a little bit. Excellent sources of carbohydrates are fruits, beans and legumes, dairy products, and historically, whole grains have been included in that list. All of those things, except for dairy, are excellent sources of dietary fiber, which is another form of carbohydrate that we know is associated with decreased chronic disease and better overall quality of life. Added sugar is also a source of carbohydrate. Now, added sugar is different from naturally occurring sugar. Let me see if I can give you an example. A glass of milk contains sugar, lactose, that is naturally occurring. If we were to consume yogurt that is additionally sweetened, that would contain the naturally occurring sugar as well as added sugar. Just like eating, you know, an apple versus sweetened applesauce. The apple contains naturally occurring sugar. The sweetened applesauce would contain that naturally occurring sugar plus the additional sweetener added to it. For years now, it's been recommended that we decrease our intake of added sugar, and these dietary guidelines are consistent with that recommendation.
Carmen, one note that the guidelines make is for moms who can breastfeed, and that says they should breastfeed their child as long as possible. What do you think of that?
Definitely, and thank you. I'm really glad that we're talking about this, and specifically with breastfeeding. And I know that breastfeeding has also been within previous dietary guidelines. So breastfeeding, the recommendation to breastfeed as long as possible is really grounded in evidence that breastfeeding offers benefits for both infants and parents. Breast milk provides immune protection. It can also support infant development. And some research also shows that it can prevent chronic disease in the baby's adulthood. So from a biological standpoint, breastfeeding can remain beneficial well beyond infancy. However, and really this part is quite important, is that this recommendation is not meant to be like a mandate. And many parents face real barriers to breastfeeding, such as returning to work, lack of paid leave, limited pumping accommodations, medical issues, and so forth. So when the guidelines say as long as possible, that really needs to be interpreted realistically. And for many families, that simply means as long as it works for both the baby and the parent. However, like formula feeding, combination feeding, breastfeeding are all valid ways to nourish a child. And the goal isn't really like maximal breastfeeding until it's really it's a fed baby and a well-supported parent.
Yeah, I'm thinking of that. I had to Google it because I misremembered what publication it was in. But that Time magazine cover from like 2012, if you remember, there was like a kid standing on a chair, still breastfeeding. Obviously engineered to generate controversy. But I suppose that, does that comport with what the
Oh,
recommendations
yeah.
are now? Yeah.
Oh, most definitely. I mean, I worked at WIC for a couple of years as well, the Women and Infants and Children a federally funded program as well. And we would see breastfeeding people that would come in and it was, 5 years old, 6 years old. And yes, most definitely. Again, if it's supporting, it really does support the relationship between a parent and a child. And if the parent is well supported now, however, there are also other circumstances where I would see the breastfeeding person say, "I can't, I just can't do this anymore. I really need the baby or my toddler, 2, 3 year old, to be able to feed 100% independently because it can be really like nurturing for the baby or for the infant or excuse me, for the toddlers." And so what happens at that point though is like, okay, well, the parent is feeling overwhelmed, so maybe it's time to start weaning. But yes, if it does support the development of children, and if both the parent and the child are still 100% on board with continuing on with breastfeeding. And of course, this isn't to say that it's a full supplement. I think that that's another important part of it, is that they're not going to be at 5 years old or 2 years old or 3 years old 100% breastfeeding. This would be a breastfeeding maybe for bedtime, or possibly, and then also, of course, they're going to be consuming their regular meals, so like breakfast, lunch, dinner, and then breastfeeding on the side to really promote that parent-child relationship.
Jennifer, one question that came up for us when we were reviewing this from somebody I was talking to about this is the idea of with pushing for red meat and whole fat dairy, are there concerns about cholesterol? Is that something people should still be thinking about?
There are definitely concerns. Whether or not they are cholesterol, I think is the question. So we know a lot of people struggle with high cholesterol, and high cholesterol, particularly the LDL cholesterol, is associated with greater risk for cardiovascular disease. Interestingly, though, we don't see a strong correlation between dietary cholesterol intake and circulating cholesterol levels. It seems to be that your genetic potential for synthesizing cholesterol and how well that's regulated may be more impactful for what your circulating cholesterol levels are. That being said, foods that are high in cholesterol tend to be high in saturated fat, like red meat, like cheese, like butter. like whole fat dairy. So I would say saturated fat is the bigger concern here. And we know that higher intake of saturated fat is associated with higher levels of cardiovascular disease. So to put, I'm looking at the food pyramid right now, to put red meat, cheese, right at the top is a little disconcerting for that cardiovascular disease risk.
Interesting. Carmen, do you have anything you want to add to that? I mean, what do you understand is going on here then, right? Surely someone must have pointed this out to them when they were putting this together, yeah?
I agree with Dr. Barnes, most definitely. I think that it's the conflicting messaging that we're seeing within the actual within the image itself of the inverted pyramid. And really, if you go to the website and then really as you're scrolling down and then they're introducing the new pyramid, and then really the first image that comes up and like the first food that comes up on the pyramid is a large steak, and then it's followed by whole fat dairy products, and then after that it's like maybe some leaner sources of protein. There's like chicken and salmon below that as well. However, I do believe that with that being like that first messaging that you really see, even though it's like a recommended overall, like okay, yes, they're recommending higher protein in general. Like really, like the implicit messaging from that image is okay, but really prioritize these very specific sources.
Interesting. What do you think, Carmen, I'll ask you about this. What do you think about this emphasis on like food dyes, right? I guess this goes under the ultra processed category, but there does seem to be specific concern about food dyes that has come up a lot with the, the present administration, the whole Make America Healthy Again, movement.
Yes, this has actually been one that has been on the rise for more like media attention, or for even within our dietary guidelines as well, like synthetic food dyes. And now I know that many companies have started to ban like synthetic food dyes from their food products. Now I think that again, it's really important to go back to the research, and research does show that a small subset of children may be sensitive to these synthetic food dyes. However, findings are quite inconsistent, and additional research is needed to better really understand the relationship between diet, food additives, and child behavior. And I think that we might have, although the relationship might be there, findings are quite inconsistent at this point, and I think that they're introduced a little bit early within our dietary guidelines. I think as we're finding out a little bit more about them, maybe something for consideration for the next set of guidelines in 2030.
So the dietary guidelines also mention that these changes were made with chronic disease in mind. And I guess, Jennifer, I'll come back to you. Can you talk about the role of food in chronic disease prevention? I think it's probably intuitive for people that, diabetes, for example, obviously very tied to what we eat, but also cancers and Alzheimer's, and there are other risks that maybe do have some association with food choices.
The association between diet and lifestyle and chronic disease is undeniable for sure. You mentioned a lot of metabolic diseases that come to mind first, like cardiovascular disease, diabetes, but also, as you said, the less intuitive ones like cancer and Alzheimer's. And so we have an opportunity with our lifestyle to decrease the incidence of these chronic diseases. We tend to be more reactive in the US rather than preventative. And the reactions are expensive, invasive interventions, right? Things like pharmaceuticals and surgeries and lifelong therapies. If we can shift our mindset to prevention and modifying our, day-to-day intake, increasing our physical activity, then we have a real opportunity to decrease some of these incidences of chronic disease. The Dietary Guidelines for Americans are one of our opportunities to educate the public And I think, unfortunately, we're missing our mark a bit here with this new pyramid, with the emphasis of these high saturated fat foods and the de-emphasis on whole grains.
So, okay, de-emphasis on whole grains. So I guess that's, that raises the question then. Is the government focusing on the right issues in terms of its disease, alleged disease prevention efforts here, I guess?
I can jump in a little bit here,
Yeah,
and I think
please.
that was a really great segue, or Dr. Barnes. I believe that with chronic diseases, and again, we mentioned conditions such as metabolic diseases, heart disease, diabetes. There's also autoimmune diseases, mental health conditions. Many of these are influenced not just by or not just by diet, but also genetics, aging, environmental exposures, stress, access to care, and all the lifestyle factors like nutrition and physical activity are 100% very much important in the prevention. There's also sleep and stress management. And we spend far more money treating disease after it develops than preventing it earlier. And nutrition is one piece of prevention, but it really works best when paired with structural supports like access to affordable food, safe neighborhoods, healthcare access, and really just time to take care of ourselves. So when we talk about the dietary guidelines in this context, we're thinking about how it places a lot of emphasis on this that people have must have like this willpower to be able to change their nutrition and so forth. However, this is again one piece of the puzzle. Trying to, of course, maximize the amount of health promotion that we can around the foods that we purchase. However, again, many other systemic and structural supports that are going to be needed in order to really fulfill chronic disease prevention.
Just about a minute and a minute and a half left, and I know this is a big topic, but Jennifer, just can we talk briefly about trust in government, right? This is the same government, the same agencies that are suggesting the public might want to reconsider the use of the polio vaccine. Why, how can people trust in this advice that it's, grounded in science, that it's doing, trying to do the right thing by people?
Well, to be very blunt, at this point, I don't know if we can. I'm seeing a lot of parallels, like you just alluded to, between these dietary guidelines and our new vaccine recommendations. I think the best thing the public can do at this point is turn to the professionals that are still relying on the evidence. So, for example, with the vaccines, the American Academy of Pediatrics are putting out their own guidelines. The Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics has put out a statement related to these dietary guidelines. So I think the checks and balances between what the government is suggesting, we need to double check with what experts in the field are recommending.
Do your own research, I guess, for better and worse.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, we're gonna have to leave it there. Jennifer Barnes is a professor in food, nutrition, and dietetics at Illinois State University. Carmen Ramos, assistant professor of nutrition and dietetics at Northern Illinois University. Thank you both for sharing your time and expertise with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, tax season is almost over. If you haven't filed yet, we'll talk about some of the changes made to federal law this year that might affect how much you have to pay. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.